Looks like Coast Guard surplus.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the August meeting of the Forest Practices Board. This is the third regular meeting for this board for this year. We anticipate having one more meeting in November. Thank you all for attending. And to get things started, and thank you, Dave. I was a little worried about you there for a moment. And to get things started, I think we'd like to go through introductions. But before we do that, I've got just a little piece of board business to carry out. David Haragawa has retired from the board. He's not here today, so I can't give him his plaque in recognition. But I wanted to mention the fact that he'll no longer be with us and that we will be sending his plaque to him. And taking his position is Paula Swedeen on my right here. And I want to welcome you, Paula, to the board. And then to get going with introductions, starting on my right, Bill, please.
You know who I am.
I know, but maybe everybody else doesn't.
My name's Bill Little. I represent the timber unions.
Norm Schaff, general public member.
Doug Stinson, general public member, small landowner.
I'm Dave Herrera, general public member.
Carolyn Dobbs, general public member. Paula Swedeen, general public member.
Tom Davis, here representing State Department of Agriculture.
Sherry Fox, representing the independent contract logger. Morning.
Dave Summers, representing counties.
Anna Jackson, WDFW.
Paul Saki, representing the State Department of Commerce.
Morning, everybody. Tom Laurie, ecology.
All right, thank you. The full board is here, and thank you all for attending today. I think, as we all know from looking at the agenda, we have a full day ahead of us, so we need to get going. The first item on today's agenda is approval of the minutes, which have been distributed to the board members. What's your discretion here with the minutes, please?
I move that we pass them.
You want to adopt the minutes as published?
Yes.
Second.
All right, we have a motion to adopt the minutes as published. And it's been seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for a vote. Everybody raise your hand if you approve of that motion. Okay, that's a unanimous vote. Thank you very much for that.
I want an abstention registered because I wasn't here.
Sorry?
I want an abstention registered since I wasn't here.
Okay.
No, Carolyn, I thought about that too. I wasn't here either, so yeah. Probably should have two abstentions.
I think you could vote to approve them even though you weren't here. I think that's entirely within your ability, so I wouldn't worry. I wouldn't fuss about that. Moving on then to my report, and given the length of time that transpired between meetings, there are just a few things I want to mention here. First of all, I think it's important for the board to understand that the state's budget is tough and getting tougher by the month. We already know that the general fund is under a lot of pressure, and I've been informed by various members of the governor's staff that we can anticipate at least a $3 billion hole in the state's budget that we must solve during the upcoming legislative session for the 11-13 biennium. And I say at least because there are early indications that it's going to be considerably worse than that. Forest practices in this board are funded entirely by general fund. And that and other reasons, including House Bill 2617, call out the need to run these public boards as economically as we possibly can. And we will have a staff report on this yet today, but I just wanted to let you know that we will be looking at different ways of operating this board in a more cost-efficient manner. So we must look for every opportunity to save dollars. And this board is one of those entities that's going to have to look carefully at that. I think we all know that meetings are, of course, a major expenditure for the board. And that to the degree that we can adhere to four regular meetings, that's one of our best ways to save money right off the start, but also the possibility of saving money even as we conduct our regular meetings. We're going to have to examine all possibilities there. The other budget that this board should be aware of is the adaptive management budget, which, as you know, we've been working hard on, and we think we have a fix for this fiscal year. I think many entities helped, although basically different aspects of DNR helped out a lot to provide the funding. We're hopeful that the EPA grant that was requested is approved, and we may hear a report from the staff about that a little bit later as to what the status of that is. The last $500,000 that was needed to fulfill the budget. So just so this board knows that we're working on the adaptive management budget, and we'll look for your help and counsel to find a long-term solution to that. So then the next item on this morning's agenda will be an opportunity for public comment on general board topics. I'll ask staff if anyone has signed up to make a comment. I think the board will remember that we provide lots of opportunity for public comment. And indeed, we have three individuals who signed up to comment at this time. And the first individual is Tom Holt. I'll just remind members of the public today about the two-minute rule, please. We welcome public comment, but we ask you to abide by the two-minute rule. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Commissioner Goldmark and board members. My name is Tom Holt, and I am the general manager of Forest Capital Partners Western Operations. And later today, you'll hear a staff report presented by Julie Sackett about Forest Capital's activities since we purchased the property in Northeast Washington from Boise Cascade. And I just wanted to let the board know that I'm here in the audience and following the presentation. If there are any questions that I might attempt to clarify your questions, I'll attempt to do so. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Rick Dunning. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and board members, and Paula, welcome. It's good to see you. I think it's been many years since you and I did a small landowner incentive report to this board back in Woodward, I think it was quite a while ago. For the record, my name is Rick Dunning, and I'm representing the Washington Farm Forestry Association and the Small Forest Landowners of the State of Washington. And the Washington Farm Forestry Association, in our maybe final legislative effort to achieve the purpose and programs of the Forest and Fish Small Landowner Statute, which is RCW 7613, have entered into discussions with the House Natural Resource Committee to correct what we've been unable to achieve through forest and fish policy process. On July 27th, we gave a 50-minute presentation to the House Natural Resource Committee and its chair, Representative Blake. And this presentation was a response to legislation that we introduced in 2010, and it was for an expansion of an existing small forest landowner rule, which I have the RCW attached to your notes there. And through that process, that year it became a joint natural resource bill, Senate Bill 6776. In our presentation, we describe our interpretation of House Bill 2091 and the three programs to be developed for small forest landowners in the state of Washington. We then showed how these programs have been unfulfilled or marginalized, and Chairman Blake and his committee requested DNR staff to work with us on this effort. You can view this presentation and the questions asked by the committee, and it'd be very educational for you if you had the time to do that. We provided the link there to the TVW program. So, Mr. Chair, speaking on behalf of the Executive Board of the WFFA, I respectfully request 20 minutes on your November 9th agenda for this Forest Practice Board to present the need and the implication of this legislation to this board.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kara Whitaker.
Good morning, Kara.
Good morning.
am Cara Whitaker. I'm a staff scientist at the Washington Forest Law Center. And I was contacted by the group Log Smarter from Northeast Washington regarding their concerns about the aggressive forest practices of forest capital partners. They believe are threatening the forest ecology and long-term economy in their regions. So on their behalf, I've begun an investigation of the practices of their timber harvesting and pesticide spraying based on analysis of public records made available from DNR. Forest Capital claims that their forest management strategies are ecologically sustainable, but as a TIMO, or Timber Investment Management Organization, their top priority really is to maximize returns for their investors. So during the last 5.5 years since they purchased lands from Boise Cascade, they've sprayed over 14,000 acres, clear cut over 24,000 acres, and thinned almost 34,000 acres. And one of the handouts is a map of those areas that I created based on the public records. All of these harvest activities combined, not including spraying, but the clear cutting and thinning and other harvest activities, cover over 62,000 acres, or 23% of their ownership over the last 5.5 years. This large-scale aggressive forestry may maximize tree growth for the out-of-state investors, but we don't agree that these practices are ecologically sustainable in this arid forest ecosystem, especially when they're considered cumulatively. Although the practices may be in compliance with the forest practices rules, this silvicultural strategy is new to Eastern Washington, and it is unknown whether or not the rules are effective at protecting the public resources in this scenario. Forest Capital cannot cite existing research that demonstrates such effectiveness. I suggest we initiate a new CEMER study to address this question. I also am distributing a letter from Log Smarter directly that is calling for rule changes that protect the dryland forests that take into account these cumulative effects, and has been signed by over 1,000 signatures. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Peter Goldman. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Board. There are three work groups that are engaging right now, and I just wanted to comment on the idea of consensus rulemaking. It's generally a good idea. Right now we have the RMAP work group, the Watershed Analysis work group, and the Spotted Owl work group. And all of these work groups are outgrowths of efforts and initiatives here at the board to review these rules after several years of inaction. As I said, I think that these work groups they're encouraging, but I thought I would just say, request this board to watch carefully what they're doing and ask, are we meeting the resource targets? Are we meeting them on time? Are we just holding meetings? Are we just getting somewhere? Are we just a lot of process? At the end of the day, it's this board's statutory duty to make sure that the rules are being improved on the ground, and it just shouldn't be the lowest common denominator what everybody can agree to. This board should set its own independent targets and resource goals. And these work groups are important, but I urge you to ask the hard probing questions when you receive staff reports on the work groups to ensure that they are actually getting somewhere. The second thing I thought I would say is that I'd like to thank Ecology for their vigilance in the Clean Water, on the Clean Water Act studies related to forest and fish. Probably one of the most important things this board can do is ensuring that this Forest and Fish Adaptive Management Program has sufficient funds and gets these studies done. Ecology has correctly recognized some of the critical studies that have to be done with all of the Clean Water Act assurances hanging in the balance depending on some of the outcomes of these studies. So I want to just thank Ecology for reminding us how important these studies are and that we have sufficient resources and not be distracted in the Forest and Fish Adaptive Management process from actually completing these studies and filling in the blanks that were left unfilled in the Forest and Fish rule package. Thank you.
you. And that concludes our public comments on the individuals that are signed during this period. So we'll move on then to staff reports. Adaptive management. Jim, hold that. Morning, Jim.
Good morning. Good morning, Chairman, members of the board. My staff report this month was once again reporting on several projects that are either completed, nearly completed, or will be going through the ISPR process in the next few months. So that's on the staff report. The one thing I do want to say is that on the EPA grants that we submitted proposals for last spring, earlier we thought we would hear on success in May. That became June, that became July. The word on the street now is that we should be hearing very, very shortly on the status of those. So we may not hear some good news in the next day or two.
And at least one of those has a bearing on the adaptive management program, correct?
All three. Okay. One of them is an effectiveness study on our buffers on soft rock lithologies. Another one is road construction and road mitigation. And the third one was an information for developing an information management system to store all of our data, reports, study designs, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you. Board manual update. Mark?
Good morning, Chairman Goldmark and members of the board. I'm going to actually do the two staff reports right back to back. That's the board manual update and then the rulemaking. The board manual update is the same as last time. We're still going to initiate development of Board Manual Section 18, Guidelines for Riparian Open Space. As the board approves the 30-day review of rule language, and we're moving towards rulemaking on riparian open space. There are no other board manuals planned at this time. However, as a result of some recommendations coming from policy in the near future, we will initiate board manual amendments of the roads manual and watershed analysis, potentially. For rulemaking, as you see on your agenda today, we have a pretty ambitious rulemaking schedule currently. Today we will address, or the board will address, riparian open space rulemaking. The expedited rulemaking for the administrative appeals, that's to eliminate the Forest Practices Appeals Board. And the notice of forest practices to affected Indian tribes, we are still working on potential rule language for the board to review for a 30-day review. As part of the rulemaking schedule, we do have a work plan for the board. And there are a few changes on this work plan than what's reported to you. Under the annual reports, the Cultural Resources Committee annual report will be at the November meeting. The compliance monitoring report will also be given at the November meeting. And the upland wildlife is actually ongoing. It is not completed. And with that, do you have any questions?
Mark, does the Riparian Open Space Program also contain any language of prioritization?
Yes, it does.
It will. It will?
Yes.
Based on natural criteria or whatever is the best habitat?
A variety of factors. It's actually going to be split into two parts. That would be the channel migration portion, which has been expanded now to all of all CMZs. And then there's the new element, which is for the habitats of threatened endangered species as identified by this board.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mark. Compliance monitoring, walk over, Mark.
Good morning, Walt. Good morning, Commissioner and board members. I just want to give you a brief update on what has happened since I sent out that report in July. The biennial report is progressing pretty well. The the data essential for comparison between the 2000, the last biennial report and this biennial report has been provided to the statistician, and we're now working on the data for the wetlands and alternate plans emphasis samples that we took in the last 3 years. So we plan to have separate sections in the report for a longer discussion between rules and application compliance, and I also want to address application features that the report has discussed, and we discussed that with the communication staff. So we've got the structure available or ready to go, and we have an optimistic schedule to produce a report by November 1st. And then a presentation to the board during the November meeting. We have some delay risks, and they include unanticipated data problems with the wetlands and the synthesis data. And also, we provide a pretty extensive comment period for the stakeholder review. And so, depending on the level of those comments we get back, that could push it out a little farther. To address that, we are doing the sections, and I want to give drafts of the sections to the members of Ecology and Wildlife that work in the program so we get some of that comment kind of up front before it goes to the stakeholders. So the stakeholders get that full draft, and then probably in September sometime we'll be reviewing that and getting the comments back to us. So, but in any case, if the report isn't published, I expect to be able to present a verbal report on the analysis at the November meeting.
All right. Thank you. Any questions from the board? All right. We'll look forward to your report in November. Thank you. Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee and Small Forest Landowner Office. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Commissioner, members of the board. My name is Mary McDonald. I'm the Small Forest Landowner Office Manager. From the update that I sent out back in July, I'd like to just update you a little bit on the forest repair and easement program. We were given two deliverables from the proviso language for fiscal year 2011. One was to implement as many acquisitions of prep as we could with the priorities that were given to us by the legislature. And then another deliverable was to have recommended language to Office of Financial Management and the legislature by October. And we have sent out, we've had two public meetings since this, and the last one was last night in Centralia, and we had one in Spokane, and we have another public meeting on August 30th to put forward our recommendations, draft recommendations. If there's any questions?
All right, thank you. So that concludes our staff report for today. And the next item is a forest practices board plan. Sorry?
One more report?
Pardon?
One more staff report?
I'm sorry, there is one more. I missed that one. That's the TFW Cultural Resources Committee. My apologies for overlooking that. Sorry about that. Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner and members of the board, and welcome, Paula. Nice to see you on the board. My co-chair is not here, so I feel a little odd, but we did provide our usual work plan to the board for you to review. I can also say that I believe that one of our projects is to get some agreement on particular rule language for section 222.2.2.2.1.20, which is notification of tribes. And I think we're very close to that. And I think we will be able to, working with staff, deliver to staff a consensus recommendation on how that rule should be modified in order to meet the needs that have been raised to us by landowners, tribes, and by the department. So you should have that to begin action on, hopefully in November. Are there any questions? Oh, here's Jeff.
Good morning.
Good morning. That's a timely entrance. Do you have any questions for the committee?
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to make one comment on behalf of at least Paul Tryon and maybe committee. I haven't discussed this with them. I wanted to just mention the concept of integration. That cultural resources is a topic that is multidisciplinary, or interdisciplinary and multi-scalar. And I don't know if really much work that's being done to integrate cultural resources with natural resource protection and management work being done at the state level or even at a local level. I believe that that's critical. And so just want to say that on behalf of Puyallup Tribe, and maybe we look forward to either showing interest in that or finding out what they believe is really necessary along those lines.
All right, thank you.
So I think that finally that now concludes staff reports. And now we invite Mark back.
Mr. Chair, we missed the safety briefing.
You did.
Probably should cover that.
Okay.
I want to let Shane off the hook.
Patricia?
Good morning and welcome to the Natural Resources Building. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the double doors. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In the event of any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out of the building using the double doors again in the front, then the first door on your left, moving away from the building towards the grassy area along Jefferson Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to emergencies.
Thank you, Patricia. Moving on then, another report from Mark on possible ways to address House Bill 2617.
Good morning again. In your packet, there's a memo addressing House Bill 2617. This bill addressed all boards and commissions in the state. The Forest Practices Board is a Class 4 board, and we've been asked to reduce costs for this fiscal year, beginning July 1 and going through next June 30. The OFM asked for us to report to them by July 15th, offering some cost savings, which staff did do, and in that we stated that we would only hold 4 regularly scheduled meetings this year, no special meetings. In addition to that, we'd like to have a discussion with the board to see if there are any other cost-saving measures that the board could do. In the lower part of the memo, it states that 2617 asks the board to, when feasible, use a meeting format that does not require travel while still maximizing member and public participation. Use a meeting format that requires members to be physically present on location only when necessary or required by law, and use state facilities for meetings that require members' physical presence at one location. This room is in a state building. It's a very good location. It offers the ability for the public to attend meetings. Staff has brought forward one potential cost-saving measure, and that would be to have phone conference calls with go-to meetings, which is a format where you can see all of the materials that people in this room are seeing on your computer. We have not tested yet for all board member locations if they have the capacity to link up to a go-to meeting. However, as a cost-saving measure, we could have people go to other DNR region offices and view it there. With that, I'd like to open up the discussion to the board if they would like this idea, or if there are any other ideas you'd like to bring forward to staff.
So I thought I'd just let the board know that DNR holds quarterly staff meetings, and in the past those meetings have caused a lot of travel where senior staff have traveled to Olympia 4 times a year to attend a meeting. But we had that meeting yesterday in the same room, and all of our region folks that would have had to travel attended by media. And it was a little rough the third meeting that we had in this fashion. The first meeting was a little rough. The media was not quite as well tuned as we hoped it would be. but we're using web-based media now, so it's fairly, it's pretty good real time, and although it's not perfect, on the screen are all the different locations, our six regions are there, and so it's very interactive, and material can be exchanged through web. So that's the format we've adopted some time ago. I won't say it's the same as being in the room, but it's a lot cheaper than the travel that would be required. So it is a good way to keep costs down. I think that's a little bit what Mark is suggesting that we talk about and consider.
So is this visual or just audio and written?
Pardon?
Is it visual or just audio and, you know, written stuff?
No, it's audio visual.
Okay.
And of course, web-based, then we can communicate with them written documents as well.
And then how have the public been, or do they don't come to the staff meetings?
It's not a public meeting, no. It's a staff meeting for working on. But staff, for instance, if we were to do something like that for this board, the public could obviously be here, and remotely we could bring in board members who would otherwise have had to travel. So the idea is to keep travel costs down through that process.
So that was a video conferencing capability, that would mean traveling to a location which we can have a video link.
Right.
Mark, where is the main cost for the board meeting? I mean, is it compensation for board members getting here, or where is it? I don't see any big dollars saved by, you know, my traveling up here. I'd be certainly willing to forfeit any compensation, you know, to be here. I mean, is that an item?
Well, thank you for that offer, but Mark, will you answer quickly?
Yeah, the cost comes from, as you might imagine, a number of sources. The compensation to board members is not part of this legislation. So, but it is a combination of a stipend to those board members that are appointed by the governor, as well as the travel costs per diem if anybody's in travel status. In addition to that, we have the cost to make all of the board packets, and staff costs associated with board are actually the greatest cost. But those costs are the rulemaking efforts that we have to undergo, the preparation of the economic analysis, the SBEIS, and the environmental analysis. All of the behind the scenes work that staff has to do to prepare a rulemaking, or for that matter, a board meeting.
That's not going to go away.
Now, those costs could be managed if the board were to choose to reduce the number of rulemakings.
Well,
I'm not suggesting.
Just to be clear here, I've had a discussion with board staff, and we're making reductions in terms of board staff time and expenditure. So we're already working on one of the major components of the expense. But I think the legislation is for all expenditures, including travel and per diem, and offers such as yours, Doug, are welcome. And I think they'll probably take you up on it.
You spoke a little early, Doug. I have a question. Seems like to me the board has already taken some steps by eliminating our usual board retreat that we would have in the fall. So that was probably one of the most expensive meetings that this board incurred during the year. So that's quite a bit. I've been on these go-to meetings, and it really takes away from the interaction between board members, which I think is a very important part of our decision-making process, is that board members are able to talk to each other in breaks, they're able to get a sense of where they might be going on a particular issue. We would lose that, and we would lose the personal contact between each other as board members. So it's not really something I'm really excited about, Commissioner.
I don't think anybody's excited about this at all, but it is something that we've been given a clear duty to respond to. And so we're trying to be responsive to the legislature.
So could we have a pilot where we would try it for one or two meetings and then have a discussion, have a sunset, unless we discuss and decide to continue it?
we can do whatever we want in that regard. I mean, we can try. I mean, to a certain degree, I agree with Sherry in the sense that how many meetings did we have in calendar year 09?
We had two or three special meetings.
We had one real banner year. I think there were 10 meetings. I don't believe that was 09. It may have been 08.
So just by adhering to the four meetings, we'll be reducing expenditures considerably. But we just want to interact with you all so that you understand both the intent and see what you're comfortable with doing in terms of adhering to the legislature's intent.
I have an answer. We had 10 meetings.
In 08
and 09.
So we set a good baseline for those two.
Yeah. Obviously, we'll be a little more careful about special meetings in the future.
I move we reduce those by 10% for 2010.
That's a hard one.
Mr. Commissioner, I agree with several of the comments that have been made that this face-to-face meeting does provide a good opportunity for us as board members to interact with each other as well as with members of the public that have an awful lot invested in this, and this may be our best opportunity to have those conversations, especially as various discussions are evolving during a meeting or throughout a day, and that's difficult, if not impossible, to happen, and maybe even more distracting than some of the note passing and phone calls and other kinds of things that have come up as issues in other meetings. And then also having participated in one of these meetings by phone, I think I've made all the rest of them in person, it was very, very difficult to participate by phone, and granted, part of that was due to the circumstances I was in at that time, but it still makes it difficult to be fully engaged. I would encourage us to look at any other opportunity that could present itself first to achieve cost savings before we would look at that one.
Actually, there are only a few of us that aren't pretty local.
I mean, right.
We sweep Doug into local and Sherry, but really just...
Yeah, I think I drive the farthest. Yeah.
Well, I think the discussion is useful, but it's important to remember, as much as anything, we want you to understand the constraints that we're under, and I think how we conduct our business, and we try and be as productive as we can with the time that we have for these meetings. I think that will be a good step. Not that we haven't in the past, but we should redouble our efforts to do so. Obviously, we've had discussions within the agency as to how we can keep our staff costs down, and we'll continue to have those. And please understand, we may not be just as working in advance as we might have been, but we have taken efforts to reduce our staff costs. I'm not sure exactly what that savings is at this time, but I think it's at least 10%.
I can't give you a figure right now, but I can tell you that just holding to the four special meetings was a substantial reduction over the baseline that you pointed out. We had to compare to 08 and 09, and in doing that, I think we had 8 meetings or somewhere in that neighborhood in 08 and 10 in 09. So holding to the four was, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was tens of thousands of dollars in savings over those two previous fiscal years. And then we're going to look further at what else we can do, but just recall that the staff costs are completely driven by the forwards work plan. So we have limited opportunity to save a lot more money here, but we will do what we can.
And obviously the connection between number of meetings and staff costs is very direct. So again, we need to make sure that we adhere to the regular meetings at this point.
I think that point needs to be reinforced because some of the things that would enable only four meetings a year are going to drive staff costs because activities will need to take place outside board meetings, an increase in that likely. So your cautionary note is well taken. There is a direct relationship between the two things, and you can try and adhere to four meetings, but what that's going to require in order to live with is more activity outside of meetings, not less.
Any other comments?
I would add order, simply a reduced pace of progress on the board's work.
Just have one question.
Yes.
And that is the go-to-meetings approach, is, I'm assuming there's a cost to that as well. And
I do not believe it's a real high cost. And there's also a cost associated with a conference call.
If we have further discussions down the road, it would be nice to see a comparison between holding meetings in one place or other alternatives.
We didn't come with the actual dollar amounts. We're more looking at cost savings. So if we can reduce the costs, that will meet the objective of the legislature. And again, the previous two fiscal years are the baseline from which this year will be compared. So if we reduce the number of meetings, we would definitely show cost savings. And yeah, I believe 2 years ago we did have a retreat, and the retreats were pretty expensive. So when you look at those 2 years and compare that to what we have proposed for this year, just holding the four regular meetings, there is a cost savings there. The discussion right now, however, is it is good for the board to actually be aware of what the legislature has asked for and to discuss further cost savings in addition to the four regular meetings.
I see. If we do slow down our rate of getting through the work program of necessity, then it really is incumbent on all of us to give particular attention to the prioritizing of which ones go first. More so from the past than the past, although I think we've always been cognizant of that need.
Yes, Dave?
Just one comment. If we do find ourselves in a particular meeting, having several members needing to do conference, the go-to meeting does work a lot better just in straight conference call. It adds significantly to the ability to track, keep track of where you are, so it is a good tool. Yeah. It's not as good as the first, so it's substantially better than just a conference call.
Yes. I would just add one other thing about this legislation, and that is all other boards and commissions except Class 4 boards cannot meet at all this fiscal year. The legislature completely eliminated in-person meetings, and it asked Class 4 boards to do what they could to reduce travel costs associated with their meetings. So it's only because this board is a Class 4 board that the meetings haven't been eliminated. The in-person meetings haven't been eliminated altogether. You can still meet, and you can still have special meetings, but those would need to be through other meetings, either by phone or otherwise, in order to keep costs down. So perhaps giving the go-to meeting a try might be a good idea. The legislature is watching, OFM is watching very closely how boards respond to this legislative guidance.
Commissioner, maybe it would be a good idea to actually try to get some numbers on what the cost savings would be if we did a go-to meeting versus compensation for travel for board members that do, and see if there is a significant cost savings, and see whether or not it's worth the trade-off of the loss of those at this time. And if the cost savings is relatively minor, then perhaps we could.
But at least make an informed decision. That's what your counsel. I think that's probably your counsel. Does that meet with everyone's approval? Yeah, it makes good sense. So maybe you can report back to the board in the interim, please, Mark.
Yes, we will do that.
Mr. Chuck. And
to do that, what we're going to have to do probably is contact board members and ask some questions about your capabilities at home to decide whether you get the internet capacity at home to do that, or do we have to travel to the region office. So expect a phone call to kind of flush that out.
Excuse me for the opinion.
just had a question about what the next steps for this would be. Are we going to discuss this further at the next meeting, or is this just idea generating?
I think it's idea generating. We'll probably discuss it again at the next meeting. My suspicion is that there might be some very modest cost savings, and that we'll need to have that informed discussion. I think that's the obvious path here, is to make a decision based on what the alternatives might yield. Do you have some further comment, Mark?
Yes, I do, Commissioner. I have an amazing staff.
Yes, they've done this already.
The travel cost for board members averages almost exactly $500 per meeting. The cost for the conference call I go to is $168, so we could round it to $200. So your cost savings would be about $300 per meeting.
That's a potential cost savings from such a format.
Yes. And you're also taking into consideration some board members that don't even ask for travel time, right? Or just go straight across the border and travel.
It's actual.
That's actual cost today.
Thank you.
Chuck?
Again, though, that at this point I say is incomplete information, because there may well be some of you who, instead of traveling to Olympia, are still going to have to travel to a region office.
Yeah.
So you need to ask that question and possibly modify that based on the order.
Yes, so I did round it up some, and I believe that we would have to test the capability of some of the more remote locations to see if there's the capacity for the go-to meeting.
So would
it be useful to get the specs for what you need to be able to go to the meeting?
So we do have some information. Staff has been thoughtful, but I think we need to make sure we have complete information. So my suggestion is that we wait for a staff report, consider this in more depth in November, but realizing that we can attain a considerable savings by adhering to the four regular meetings and doing it in a business-like fashion. But again, generous offers will be accepted. So moving on then, the next item, and thank you, Mark, the next item on this morning's agenda is a report on public forest practice concerns in Northeast Washington. Julie, good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner. Good morning, members of the board. I'm Julie Sackett. I'm the Assistant Division Manager for Operations. A couple of slides to go through.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The audience is having difficulty hearing board member comments and questions, so if I could just ask you to speak up.
Amp it up. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so my report is a follow-up to public comments received by Log Smarter at the May board meeting. And it pertains specifically to forest practice activities, even age harvest and aerial chemical spray application being conducted in Northeast Washington by Forest Capital. And just a refresher, Log Smarter is a local citizens group, primarily from Stevens and Ferry counties. The mission statement that you see up on the screen is directly from their website. And I spoke with Mike Slater after the meeting and the comments that he provided, just to get a better understanding of his specific concerns. And he wanted to make clear that they do not oppose logging, but really what they're looking for is a change in rules specific to even-age harvest. In Northeast Washington, they're looking at what they believe would be a more desirable even-age harvest unit limit size of 40 acres, and they also believe that additional environmental review is required or should be required for aerial chemical spray. Forest Capital was founded in 2000. They're based out of Portland, and they picked up the Boise Cascade ownership in Northeast Washington in 2005. That's roughly 265,000 acres that they acquired, and they manage under the Sustainable Forestry Initiative. Just to give you a little bit of background on harvest, regardless of whether it's even age or uneven age harvest, there are a number of rules that regulate that harvest. And what you see up on the slide here give you a flavor of some of those. This certainly does not include rules that pertain to water, riparian rules, wetlands, unstable slopes, threatened and endangered species. It also doesn't apply to road construction that may be needed for the activity. In addition, there are rules pertaining to active haul roads, and we also have the reforestation requirements for harvest. The asterisk, you notice that there was a couple of asterisks on the previous slide and then this one. Really what that indicates is there are some differences between rules on the east and west side of the state. And some examples of those are specifically to riparian protection. There's wildlife reserve tree management. There's some differences there. There's also differences with regards to reforestation standards and some differences with regards to relief culvert sizes based on east and west. This chart here, I just wanted to give you a flavor of what activity levels are like between Boise as a previous landowner and Forest Capital as the new landowner. I want to really stress that this this chart, these numbers, do not represent actual harvest that is taking place on the ground. What they represent is activity that has been permitted, approved, either with a submitted application or notification by the two different landowners. So it represents a five-year time period. Boise's time period is from January of 2000 through January of 2005. Forest Capital, you'll see their time period is 5 years, starting March of 2005 through March of this year. Another thing to keep in mind is that, again, this just represents what activity has been permitted specific to timber harvest. Applications, notifications are good for 2 years. So while this gives you an idea of what the department approved during this five-year period, this could represent activity that could extend through March of 2007. So again, it's just giving you an idea of some differences between Boise and Forest Capital. This gives you an idea of the all of the large landowners in Northeast Washington. Again, it's for the same time period. So you'll see Boise here. Boise, keep in mind, this was when they were they still had their ownership in Northeast Washington. So those numbers that you're seeing is in the dark blue. It represents the average even age harvest unit size. And in the light blue is the maximum even age harvest unit size that's been submitted in a five-year period for each of these particular companies. So Boise, these numbers were, I got these numbers from the January of 2000 through 2005. All the other landowners up there are from March of 2005 through March of 2010. Aerial chemical spray. This was another one of LuxSmart's concerns that they had, the activity that's occurring on the east side. I just wanted to let you know the rules that apply to aerial chemical spray, as well as the program's evaluation that these particular applications receive. You'll find more information in 16070. This is just kind of a summary here with these points. We use, as part of the office evaluation process, evaluation key, and it consists of 17 questions that need to be answered in order to determine the appropriate classification for that that proposal. And we use the PICL database. This is the Pesticide Information Center online database. It is supported by Washington State University, the Department, Washington Department of Agriculture, Oregon State University, and Oregon Department of Agriculture. Part of our initial evaluation is as we look for water intakes, fish hatchery, groundwater hazard areas that have been identified. We consider threatened and endangered species locations, including their critical habitat, chemical toxicity rating, that's listed on the chemical and the size of the application area. In addition, Chapter 38, WAC 22238, provides specific rules that must be adhered to for the applications. This gives you an idea of the number of rules that pertain to chemical spray. So specifically, LogSmarter had identified some general concerns pertaining to aerial chemical spray. One of them was chemical batching. This is where you take, if you have more than one herbicide that you're going to be applying, you mix them together prior to application of an area. And really what governs the ability to do that or not do that is just the label. The herbicide label will tell you what is or what is not allowed. So if the label does not prohibit the mixing, it is allowable by law to mix chemicals prior to spray. Water quality, including groundwater protection, was another general concern that LogSmarter had, and I'll refer back to the evaluation that takes place in the office looking for information on water intakes and groundwater hazard areas, as well as looking at the chemical itself. And then out in the field, we apply the buffers that are required on streams and wetlands in order to protect water quality. Public health was another concern. The Chapter 38 0204 subset G talks specifically about requirements to protect public health. And this requires a landowner who is spraying aerial spray application of chemicals that they must post the area that they're going to be applying chemical to. And they need to post that at least 5 days prior to the application being applied. And then the signing needs to stay on site for at least 15 days after completion. Now, DNR, we can condition an application to extend that period longer if we're if we have information that we know that an area is used by the public for berry picking or other recreational opportunities. Again, we can extend that to a longer period. The sign that is to be posted needs to have specific information. It needs to identify the chemicals that are being used. It needs to identify the time period it's going to be applied, and it needs to provide contact information. So if the public has questions or concerns, they know who they can contact. One of the specific concerns that LogSmarter raised, and I should let you know, the photos that you see in this presentation are all from LogSmarter's webpage. And when I spoke with Mike Slater, he gave me permission to use these in the presentation. So these all have been taken by folks within LogSmarter. So in this particular photo, this was one of their specific concerns, that they were seeing spray application on young ponderosa pine plantations. And the rules protect vegetation that are within riparian and wetland zones. If you're outside of those areas, there is no rule that prohibits a landowner from spraying and killing conifer species. What Forest Practices would be looking for is making sure that the land meets the requirements, stocking standards under the reforestation section, which is 222-34. The other specific concern that LogSmarter raised was having to do with an overspray. They were applying to a unit, and they had actually sprayed onto an adjacent landowner. The Forest Practices staff in the region investigated that incident, and what they found was the operator was at fault. A notice to comply was issued to the operator. They did not issue to the landowner in this case, or the landowner. Landowners here are Gallatin and Coulter Ridge. Forest Captain manages for both of these landowners. The Forest Practices did not issue to the landowner because they found that the unit was well-marked and highly visible. So they had met their requirements, and again, it was the operator at fault. So in summary,
The even-inch harvest unit size is compliant with forest practice rules. And the aerial chemical spray application, they had the one incident, but again, it was found that the operator was at fault, not forest capital. Do you have any questions?
I've got a question for you. So they spray to lessen the stocking on the units because, you know, on the east side we get a heavy duty stocking sort of problem. So is that the reason why they're spraying these conifers?
I can't answer specifically for that particular photo. I did contact Forest Capital to ask if they had any information specific to that, but it's a photo and not knowing exactly where it was. And there's a lot of reasons that folks, you know, may spray, so it's really hard to tell specifically for that photo.
What is the stocking level on the site?
Sherry, let me answer that question for you, because I did go over and I was on a tour there last year and looked specifically at some of Forest Capital's management practices. They spray for brush control, which they feel is very important to be posting an establishment there. And that hasn't been common amongst everybody, but they feel strongly about doing that. So that's the reason they're spraying.
Yes. what is the stocking level on these sites? Preset stocking.
For when reforestation is required, folks need to plant. They need to have a minimum 150 seedlings on site a year after the activity is
completed. But they're not necessarily required to plant. Don't they use seed trees also? Is where they get
it? It depends. So it just depends on the proposal and which way that the landowner chooses to. So there's reforestation requirements, but there's also, you know, a landowner can propose an alternative to planting seedling. They can pursue a natural regeneration, all of which are different and need to be worked out in advance with the forest practices.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Julie, thank you for this presentation and for following up from what we heard from the last meeting. This has certainly been on my mind, and I just wanted to make sure I'm clear on that the rules currently don't really address issues mixing pesticides or herbicides as long as you're following the right label requirements.
In 22238, it specifically states that you will follow all label, state, and federal regulations. And then the applicant or the landowner operator is required to follow the label directions. The Department of Agriculture is also involved in making sure that is followed.
So I think it probably just highlights that maybe it's time to just take a look at, you know, from an adaptive management perspective, do we feel like the rules are really sufficiently addressing issues that like this that are arising now. So it's, I know this board has a lot of work put out for it, but I just, I'd be interested to hear if other members feel the same and what we might propose to do about it. Not maybe for future discussion, but I recognize that the parties here have all been following the rules, and we don't have any, Fish and Wildlife doesn't have any specific issues right now, but I think it does highlight a future need.
Okay.
I had a couple of questions for clarification since I wasn't at the last meeting. So is LogSmarter essentially raising issues that they don't feel like current rules are adequate, or that Forest Capital Partners wasn't following the rules? Because your presentation was pretty clear that there weren't any rule violations.
That's right. That's correct. Yes, and LogSmarter does believe that, and they have acknowledged that the rules, to their understanding, have been followed. But they believe the rules as written are not appropriate for the conditions on the east side, specifically the dry ecosystem on the east side.
So have they expressed an intent to file a petition, or was it just a general request to us that we consider their concerns?
I know that they have solicited a petition in the area that you know that they live, and I think Cara had referenced that. But I, as far as any specific details along the petition, I am not able to answer.
Yes, yeah, so I was asking more about like a formal petition to the board to.
No.
So they're not.
Yes,
yeah.
Not to
enough.
Yes, Carol.
Could you say a little bit more about, I was writing and listening and looking at the same time, about outside the riparian zones, the rules don't apply?
All right, so, sure, if I understand correctly, the concern with regards to spraying conifer species, the rules require all vegetation within a riparian or wetland buffer zone to be protected. Now, there's some exceptions. If there's some noxious, type plant, there would be exceptions, but there would be processes to go through. But in general, those areas are protected from having chemical spray applied. But outside of those kind of special areas, there's no rule that prohibits a landowner from spraying chemical on conifer species. And
thank you.
Tom,
yeah, thank you. There was that one graph that you showed that showed the different land holdings by ownership, and it, one was the Boggan Brothers, and it seemed like theirs may have exceeded what we're talking about with risk capital. Wondering if LogSmarter had raised any concerns about Boggan Brothers. They've been operating in the area for many, many years, and or if their land holdings are in a different area from between, not in Stevens or Ferry. I'm not sure where their holdings are.
No, to my knowledge, they have not. And in talking to Mike Slater, my understanding was this really, because a lot of the folks that are part of LogSmarter live along the adjacent to the ownership now that Forest Capital manages, that they're more aware of the activities being conducted by Forest Capital. In my conversations, I've not heard him speak of any other forest land.
So just to clarify here, Julie, is Mike Slater the adjacent landowner that had the overspray issue?
That's correct, Commissioner. Okay. Yes, he is.
I think it's important for the board to understand that.
Yes.
Other questions?
Sorry, Tom. I just want to follow up on the. I guess I'm just a little concerned about using the photos from LogSmarter's website. But just as a caveat, unless I'm assuming DNR staff has been out on site and could confirm what we saw in the photographs. I don't know where those photos were taken, other than they were on the website.
Right. I spoke with Mike Slater. With regards to and confirming that those were indeed, and I could have done a better job at the beginning of my presentation to just let you know the purpose of putting those photos in here was really to give you an idea of what the folks that are part of LogSmarter are seeing and what they're responding to and reacting to, and nothing more was intended for that.
But I can add to that, Tom, because I did go on site there and was taken around on a tour by Forest Capital management there. And we did look at an area that had been even aged harvested, and there were adjacent trees, conifers, that were heavily damaged by their spray. And they acknowledged the fact that they had some formulation issues that they needed to address. So here's the even age area. Adjacent to that are conifer species. Clearly had some overspray on them. Clearly were under stress and flat.
And can I add, I just appreciate all the work that she has done on this report, and she's talked to our staff at the Department of Ag. It's been very thorough and very well done, so I appreciate it.
Other questions? Yes, Dave?
Just one follow-up question so I understand. In the material we have here, chemical application 12-year-old contours, I said that the stocking rate's 150 at what time period? Is it an issue that sometime after they meet stock rates, that they're
right, for forest practices, so if you're required to reforest and if you're going to be planting seedlings, the rules require that a landowner 12 months after, right, has to meet at least 150, vigorous, healthy, fairly evenly spaced seedlings per acre. to meet the reforestation standard. But you know, again, there's a lot of different nuances depending on exactly what kind of activity you started with, and then as a landowner, how you plan on achieving the stocking standards.
So with minerals, if there's heavy damage sometime after that 12-month period, there's really no way to come back to
for stocking. No, actually, so I'm not super skilled on going back, but if you know the picture that you saw, right, that had the damaged pine, if you looked closely, you could actually see. So, if the lighting is a little bright. So for forest practices staff coming out here, right, we see this, but like I said before, we're going to be really looking for making sure that the area meets the stocking requirements. And you can see that there's quite a few green, undamaged seedlings throughout here. Now, again, this is just one photo. It's really hard to determine the scope and scale of what we're looking at. But if we go out there and see that, hey, they still have adequate stocking, we're not going to take any action on that. Now, if there was nothing left there and say everything was completely wiped out, we would be going back to the landowner and say you're not meeting your stocking requirements.
Even if it's past a 12-month period, that's what I'm trying to get to.
Yes.
Yes. So anytime after, it's covered. You have the authority.
Yes, Dave.
Can you tell me if the spraying standards, the use of chemicals here considers the effects on wildlife and creatures that live in those habitats on those lands?
I can't answer that question. I would have to defer to Department of Agriculture with regards to the testing and the review. I really am not able to answer that question.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much, Julie.
You're welcome.
Good presentation. We appreciate the update.
So can we get a copy of the
slide? Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes. I will make sure that Patricia's going to get a copy, and then it'll get distributed, and then we'll also post it as part of the...
You're talking about electronic distribution, I hope?
Yes.
Okay.
Electronic distribution. Yes.
All right. So we have a break scheduled at 10:30. I'm going to press on until that time. So the next item on the agenda would be public comment on riparian open space rulemaking. Okay, we have no public comment on open space rulemaking, so that allows us then to move forward. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Dan Pomerick. I'm the Conservation Easement Program Specialist with the Department of Natural Resources Forest Practices Division. And I'm here to ask the board to consider approval of the riparian open space draft rule language for a 30-day review to be sent to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, counties, and tribes. And just to remind the board, this rule language is a modification of the existing rules of the riparian open space program. These modifications will only affect the rules regulating the acquisitions of conservation easements. No changes to rules that affect resource protection are being considered with this proposal. And that the DNR has worked with each policy caucus lead to assemble a stakeholder group that we've met to provide input into this proposal.
So this has gone through policy then?
It has reported it to policy. It hasn't gone to policy for approval.
Okay. So questions for staff?
What happened to your policy for approval, Dan?
The way I understand this process, and I'm kind of new to this rulemaking thing, is that this was a legislative action. And so then, because it's legislative action, it's not required to go through policy for approval.
Didn't know that. I think we've done legislators and go through policy. That was the process.
Go ahead, Darren.
This rulemaking does not affect public resource protection standards for aquatic resources. Therefore, adaptive management is not required in this rule. However, all the usual suspects are involved in developing the proposal that you have in front of you.
Yeah, I was real interested in the fact that you were getting small force landowners to apply for this program. So just trying to make sure that they're incorporated into the program.
We have a member of the Small Force Landowner Caucus on our stakeholder group that's providing input.
Who's that?
Vic Musselman.
Oh, very good. Okay. That helps me out.
Does that meet with your approval?
It does, sir.
Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, just a technical question of clarification. So we were talking about habitat for threatened and endangered species in the language, both in statute and in the proposed rule, says qualifying critical habitat lands as defined by the board. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, does that mean like official critical habitat state as defined in rule, or does the board get the ability to define what critical habitat is for the purposes of this program?
That's a good question. Our interpretation, my interpretation has been that it's defined in rule, that those critical habitats are defined in rule. But that's something that, again, that's simply my interpretation. That would be something that I'd be willing to get comment on.
Okay, so the reason I'm bringing that up, if I remember correctly, the whole initiative was brought up during the Spotted Owl Policy Work Group. Mm-hmm. And so if the definition is defined to just a critical habitat state, it means that only, for instance, Spotted Owl habitat that's defined as critical habitat state within SOCES is eligible for acquisition, but Spotted Owl habitat that may be at risk or of some contention or of some interest to a party to be a private landowner to transfer out for whatever reason outside of SOCES wouldn't be eligible. And so that's the reason I'm asking. Is it, are we intending a broader scope of application or a narrower scope of application?
At this time, I think from the stakeholder meetings, I believe it was the narrower scope, but again, that's something that...
So classified habitat?
Yeah. Habitat that's defined in rule.
So I'm seeing some disagreement in the crowd.
Well, it's something, obviously, that I'm willing to offer up as additional information for this program.
So the question is, what the draft rule language is before us is based on the clarification that Paul just made. It's just classified.
Go ahead, Mark.
To answer the question about spotted owl habitat, it's the habitat that's required to be left in rule. So, for example, if you're outside the SOCI and you're addressing the best 70, you are able to harvest that. There's a timing restriction, so that it would not apply to that. It would be for the habitat within the SOCI. Is that loud enough?
Speak up a little bit more, please.
Okay, I'll do it again. It is for the habitat that is required within rule. So, if we're using a northern spotted owl as an example, the habitat within the best 70 outside of the SOCI, this would not apply to because the landowner would be able to harvest that timber outside of the timing restrictions. It would apply, however, to all the habitat within the SOCI.
Is So does that address your concerns, then, Paula?
It answered my question.
Okay. That's the difference. Any other questions about the proposal before the board?
I do have a question, Commissioner. Are you already beginning to work on the priority list? Or how do you anticipate the priority list being put together by a stakeholder?
In the draft rule, there is two elements to a priority. Find that in here. It's on page 9, line 9. It's a subsection for prioritization for conveyance and funding. And right now we have in the draft rule conservation benefits and landowner management options. And our intent was to further define that in the board manual for quite specific criteria.
When that criteria would then go to the legislature for their review for the funding? Because it states that you're going to go to the legislature for budget considerations.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure of the question. The criteria itself would be, I believe, would be board manual, so the board to discuss and put in. And then what would go to the legislature would be potentially a list of candidates.
Mark?
Yes, to clarify that a little further, by going to the legislature, it would be that when we request capital funding for this program, part of that request would be to show the legislature that we do have a prioritization system in place and to also show them all of the individuals or landowners that have applied for funding. That's the presentation to the legislature. And it makes sense to house the actual detailed criteria within the board manual, because as this program evolves over time, the board manual is a section that we can adjust to accommodate the needs.
And so the board manual will be developed with stakeholder review and all that jazz, right?
Yes, we're going to convene the, as Darren says, the usual characters.
Mm-hmm.
We are reaching out to, and though we don't have to go to policy because this is not changing any of the protections, it's just a matter of determining how to fund a maintenance program for those landowners that have to leave timber either to CMZ or habitat. We are still going reaching out to all of the policy heads and asking for participation by all of the caucuses.
Good. I hope you keep it included in that circle.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions before we proceed? We've had a good discussion on the issue. I hope it helped sharpen everybody's awareness of what's in front of the board right now. So I believe a motion would be in order at this time.
I'll move the draft language forward. Do you have some wording that you'd like to offer?
There it is.
Thank you. I move the Forest Practice Board approve the draft rule proposal relating to the expansion of the Repairing Open Space Program for a 30-day review with the counties, DFW, and tribes. This rule incorporates provisions of 2009 Senate Bill 5401.
Okay. All right, we have a motion properly supported to advance the draft rule proposal. Discussion on the motion. We've had a pretty good discussion thus far. Call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand, please. Passes unanimously. Thank you. Is there any further action required at this point?
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And thank you for your help there, Board. I think given the hour, we're at 10:25, let's take a 10-minute break, and we can be at 10:35, please.
mention that.